namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om 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 namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
This morning from Canto 3, Chapter 16, two very nice verses, 25 and 26. Is the last of the prayers or the words spoken by the Kumaras to Lord Narayan. And then the next verse is Lord Narayan's reply. So just the sequence again is Jai and Vijay were cursed. Lord Narayan, being omniscient, came at once to the gates of Vaikuntha right before the scene of the events took place. Maybe 12 verses are there where he's praising the Kumaras, accepting the offense made by Jayan Vijay as his offense, pleading for their understanding of his position as regarding them as above him. In so many ways he describes that. And the end of his prayers, or his words to the Kumaras, is your curse shall be enforced, but please let them come back soon. And then in reply the Kumaras express, your words are very confusing. We don't know what you want of us. We don't know what you want overall. But they speak absolute truth. They speak truth, reversing the position of his being, Lord Narayan being subordinate to his devotees, and say the devotees are subordinate to you and we are subordinate to you. And the last verse that we discussed yesterday was, by this taking of the position, a humble position, subordinate to your devotee, this doesn't diminish your divinity, doesn't diminish or reduce your potency. Rather, it's done by you to facilitate your pastimes. Then here's the last verse that they speak, text 25. O Lord, whatever punishment you wish to award to these two innocent persons, or also to us, we shall accept without duplicity. We understand that we have cursed two faultless persons. So, like, you're the Supreme Court, and the arbiter of this situation. Whatever you decide, we accept in advance. Here's a blank check, fill it in, whatever you want. And twice in the same verse, they say that the Jayan Vijay were innocent, Jayan Vijay were faultless. However, do you want to do something with them? That's at your discretion. We're withdrawing our curse. Now it's in your hands. And if you want to punish us for what we did, we accept that too. Whatever you want to do. Blank slate. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The sages, the four Kumaras, now reject their cursing of the two doorkeepers, Jayan Vijay, because they are now conscious that persons who engage in the service of the Lord cannot be at fault at any stage. it is said that anyone who has implicit faith in the service of the Lord, or who actually engages in transcendental service, has all the good qualities of the demigods. Therefore, a devotee cannot be at fault. If sometimes it is found that he is in error by accident or by some temporary arrangement, that should not be taken very seriously. The cursing of Jani Vijay is here repented. Now the Kumaras are thinking in terms of their own position in the modes of passion and ignorance, although they're transcendentally realized. And they are prepared to accept any kind of punishment from the Lord. In general, when dealing with devotees, we should not try to find faults in Bhagavad Gita. It is also confirmed that the devotee who faithfully serves the Supreme Lord, even if found to commit a great mistake, gross mistake, is to be considered a sadhu or a saintly person. Due to former habits, he may commit some wrong. But because he is engaged in the service of the Lord, that wrong should not be taken very seriously. I was thinking to go back and read the passages where, as firmly and conclusively as this report is saying, even if there's no fault, even if there's fault, there's no fault, or should not be taken seriously, or that person should be considered subject. Just so it's like they're faultless, as the verse is saying, they're innocent. As firmly as this is stated, there are statements in the previous section where they were at fault. What the Lord is admitting and acknowledging is it's His words that the action of Jai Vijay was wrong, it was punishable, and so on. I mean, without reading it, there are equally strong statements. One case spoken by the Lord, and in this case spoken by the four Kumaras, and in part of his third point. So, how does this apply to us? Prabhupada makes it really easy by saying it. In general, when dealing with devotees, we should not try to find faults, or say it differently, we should try to not find faults. Why? Why? Because Krishna is enjoining in Bhagavad Gita, and that is there's conditions. Ananya bhak apichat sudaracho bhajate mam ananya bhak. If they're unflinchingly ananya. Anya means other, and ananya means no other. So there's nothing in their life but bhakti, undivided devotional service to Krishna. Vajite maam, ananya bhak, sandor eva. So we shouldn't one up Krishna. From Krishna sees this way, but Krishna just doesn't get it right. We should be like that instead of like Krishna sees it. That's not good. We should see as Krishna sees. We certainly can see their discrepancy. But we should, you know, that the larger picture is the devotion. Unalloyed devotion. And on the strength of that unalloyed devotion, Krishna corrects the situation, which he says in the next verse. He restores that devotee. He purifies their heart and rectifies whatever is the situation. We have a number of nice examples of that. Indra offending Krishna, Brahma offending Krishna, great personalities offending Krishna. And Krishna didn't, Akura being involved in conspiracy of killing his father-in-law. Krishna didn't even bring it up when he was with Akura. He just wanted the Shamataka jewel to be shown to the people of Dwarka that, you know, okay, it's everything's fine, and now Akura, you keep the Shamataka jewel. So, as practicing devotees, this is one scriptural reference from Bhagavad Gita, very important, ninth chapter, verse 30. Then another reference is Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur classic. A Vaishnava is not one who finds faults in others, or by so doing, they're simply indicating that their heart is honeycombed with the very same faults. So we don't, we don't want people to know my heart is honeycombed with faults. But it's the act of fault finding is just not a Vaishnava function. And what does one do? One can see discrepancy, but see the devotion. And my main business is making my own heart pure. If I'm going to be of any assistance in this dynamic of this devotee's life where there's some shortcoming, let me be pure in heart so I can be of service to assist elevating that situation. Not finding fault doesn't improve the situation. It's not the service act. It's something else. It doesn't produce any positive result. We discussed this a little bit yesterday evening. So now what does Lord Narayan say? Text 26. Sri Bhagavan Vacha. O Brahmanas, know that the punishment you inflicted on them was originally ordained by me. So, not only I will uphold your words, but even before you spoke the words, this was something ordained by me. And therefore, they will fall to a birth in a demoniac family. But they will be firmly united with me in thought through mental concentration intensified by anger, and they will return to my presence shortly. Interesting purport. The Lord stated that the punishment inflicted by the sages upon the doorkeepers, Jaya Vijaya, was conceived by the Lord Himself. Mm-hmm. Without the Lord's sanction, nothing can happen. It is to be understood that there was a plan in the cursing of the Lord's devotees in Vaikuntha, and His plan is explained by many stalwart authorities. The Lord sometimes, so here's the explanation. The Lord sometimes desires to fight. The fighting spirit also exists in the Supreme Lord, otherwise how could fighting manifest at all? But the Lord is, because the Lord is the source of everything, anger and fighting are also inherent in His personality. When He desires to fight with someone, He has to find an enemy. But in Vaikuntha, there is no enemy, because everyone is engaged fully in His service. Therefore, He sometimes comes to the material world as an incarnation in order to manifest His fighting spirit. Paragraph. In Bhagavad Gita 4.8, it is also said that the Lord appears just to give protection to the devotees and to annihilate the non-devotees. The non-devotees are found in the material world, not in the spiritual world. Therefore, when the Lord wants to fight, He has to come to this world. and will fight with the Supreme Lord. No one is able to fight with him. Exclamation mark. Therefore, because the Lord's pastimes in the material world are always performed with his associates, not with others, he has to find some devotee who will play the part of an enemy. Like Bhishma Dev. In Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says to Arjuna, my dear Arjuna, both you and I have appeared many, many times in this material world, but you have forgotten, whereas I remember. Thus, Jaya Vijay were selected by the Lord to fight with him in the material world. And that was the main reason the sages came to see him. And, accidentally, the doorkeepers were cursed. It was the Lord's desire to send them to the material world, not perpetually, but for some time. Therefore, just as on a theatrical stage, someone may take the part of enemy to the proprietor of the stage, although the play is for a short time, and there's no permanent enmity between the servant and the proprietor. So, there, similarly, the Sura Janas, the devotees, were cursed by the sages to go to the Asura Jana, or atheistic families. That a devotee should come into an atheistic family is surprising, but it is simply a show. After finishing their mock fighting, both the devotee and the Lord are again associated in the spiritual planets. This is very explicitly explained here. The conclusion is that no one falls from the spiritual world or Vaikuntha planet, for it is the eternal abode. Point of controversy. But sometimes, as the Lord desires, devotees come into the material world as preachers or as atheists. In each case, we must understand that there is a plan of the Lord. Lord Buddha, for example, was an incarnation. Then he preached atheism, quote, there is no God, unquote. But actually, there was a plan behind this as explained in the Bhagavatam. And that's it. No more speaking by Lord Narayan. Just, they may have been other words, but this is just presenting what he did say. And in the following purports, there's more about this, you know, the position of the goddess of fortune. It's all of what I just described yesterday, but the unique Leela that unfolded. So several things. One is, we can't understand things in a life of pure devotion on their surface. You know, because people like to read situations and read into the situation, this and that, the other thing, and you can't use that methodology in the spiritual platform system. There's no one-to-one correlation at all. But there's a tendency to do that. This person did this because of that reason, and all that analysis. But that's one thing. One can't understand properly by comparing spiritual activity to material activity. And then another is very, very, very elevated devotees like the Four Kumaras or Lord Brahma or Indra or other great devotees. They, according to the Bhagavad Gita verse, may do something very bad. Achar means behavior, Durachara means bad behavior, and Sudurachara means very bad behavior. And sometimes that may happen. Just as Krishna says, that the first line is Apichet. Apichet means even if. Bhaktisiddhanta called this working hypothesis. Something would never happen. It would never happen. But supposing it happened. Apichet. But sometimes it happens. Even if this very, 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 very unusual, rare thing happens, how do you see it properly? So the Kumaras didn't see it like that. But Jaya Vijay did. And why didn't they? Because they're so intelligent and elevated. And the answer is because inspired by the Supreme Lord within their heart. So, like Maharaj Parikshit offending the sage, and Arjuna becoming bewildered, and there's so many examples like that where an unnatural, unbecoming, uncharacteristic behavior is done by a devotee, like, you know, a very, very elevated devotee. How do we understand that? Here's how we understand that. There's a plan of the Lord, and one cannot understand the plan of the Lord. It's certainly not by superficial examination. Bhishma Dev says that to Yudhisthira in the first canto of the Bhagavad. One can't understand the plan of the Lord. So what are you doing? You can't understand the plan of the Lord. And you're going along in life, and something happens that's really unusual. Shrug your shoulders, and there's a plan of the Lord that I don't understand. So if you remain attached to the Lord, then you can be peaceful. But if you forget that, you're crushed, because sometimes things happen that are just inexplicable. And I'm sure everyone can think of some situation, I can think a number of them, that are just like, why did this happen? And it's plain to learn. Then another is, we shouldn't put ourselves in that position of the Vajite Mamananya Bhakt devotees, that we can just do discrepancy things and still consider ourselves sadhu. That's not, we don't apply the things to ourselves. Look at what Krishna says. I'm just engaged in devotional service. I don't have any interest besides devotional service, so we don't imitate. But when there are factually great devotees that do those things, that's how we have to adjust. Bhaktisiddhanta calls this the unreckonable potencies, or inconceivable potencies. The Lord has unlimited and inconceivable potencies. So when he exhibits them, inexplicable things happen. One of the questions that came after the class was, yesterday evening, was how do inexplicable things happen? How do we understand when some amazing things happen in the lives of Krishna's devotees? How do we not think this is just hyperbole? It's just like a nice story, and somebody got carried away and explained it in some like amazing way, and it's just kind of fanciful. Maybe everyone in the room has had such thoughts at some point in time about how do we address that? It's in short, the unreckonable or inconceivable potency. The Lord, he moves them, and then he can invest some of those potencies however he likes in his devotee, and they can do according to that. It's not only the devotee, it's non-devotee. Where does one's ability to do anything come from? From the same source. And so someone who's not a devotee Ravana did, you know, amazing things and so on. But even in our modern times, this description of Vishikasen, the yogi who lived in a forest outside of Puri, he had mystic powers, and he could, you know, create fire from his hair, and, you know, fire from his eyes, and, you know, curse people, and they would die, and it's like that. Wow. So that's not like just a story. That's recent history. So some person can be endowed with some powers, and someone can be endowed with other powers. And how does that happen? Because there's the all-powerful who can move his powers and potencies at his will and withdraw them at his will. If we don't have that sense, how do you explain life? Like that nice story of Narada Muni was going to see Lord Narayan, and he saw the Brahmin and the cobbler, and both asked, you know, please find out from the Lord when I'll return to the spiritual world. So when he told the cobbler that he would return at the end of his life, he said, that's very nice. And Narada was very surprised. So look at your life. You're not Suchi or Muchi. You're going to go back to Godhead. Then he gave the explanation, if the Lord can place a huge banyan tree in a little seed, he can do anything he wants. He was threading an elephant through the eye of a needle. He can do anything he wants. Wait a minute, you can't put an elephant through the eye of a needle? Materially, it's not going to happen. So, how can you just accept that? What is evil voices? So if one's heart is simple, then it becomes very easy. And if it's just based on material calculation, like I was saying yesterday, cause and effect, with the laws of material nature, it's fanciful, it's fairy tale, it's something. You know, one's faith becomes disrupted or disturbed. How is it possible? Then there's a whole other, I was thinking, speak to this devotee again, or invite them to hear the recording of this class. Here's something that is very helpful also, at least I find. There are empiric things within the Vedic literature that are measurable, and they're really far out. Like cosmology. And there's numbers affixed to Vedic cosmology. And Western, rather than through descending knowledge through the Vedas, through the process of ascending knowledge of gazing with its sensual inspection and reason and so forth, that ascending process is getting closer and closer and closer and closer to the descending knowledge. So it's very close to a one-to-one correlation of empiric evidence from the Vedic wisdom and modern astronomy or cosmology. And then one can ask the question, how do these people know these things? Now, it's all the technology. The Hubble telescopes and sending out into space and send signals back, and they zooming around, and you know they do all their calculations, and now they know the distances between this and that, and so many things, cosmology events that are becoming more and more proximate. Like, you know, when Copernicus, two revolutionary things. One is, it's this: the sun is the center, heliocentric conception of the universe, whereas historically before him, it was geocentric. And so that was, you know, since Copernicus, it's heliocentric. our solar system, sun is at the center, not the earth is at the center, and things are moving around the earth. And then with his telescope, he said the distance between the earth and the sun is X. Whatever, I forget the number. And it was off by a factor of 150 or something like that. Then they got a better telescope and got closer and closer and closer. Now it's almost the same as the Vedic picture of the distance between the earth and the sun. How did they get the number? They didn't have telescopes. How do they get a number like that? That's from descending knowledge. So Western theologians and scientists challenged the Vedic texts based on two things, archaeology and cosmology, saying time will tell as archaeology develops and so on. That this Vedic thing is rubbish. And so is all the rest of their stories. It's just imagination. Well, so the converse is, it's empirically accurate. So the things that you can't measure, why would the sages that know all these amazing things about cosmology and history just like go off on a tangent and write all these fanciful stories? It's not reasonable. It's just not reasonable in the same text. I mean, maybe they could write children's books that are fanciful. You know, he took the dash and things like that. You know, the fox and the rabbit. That's fine. But not within the same literature that's having all these very, very precise, specific, and accurate calculations and statements. Anyway, that's also helpful for someone who's... I'm speaking this not so much for the devotees in the room, but for dealing with people that have... they're going through the education system that we've also all gone through, and they're hearing, spoonful after spoonful after spoonful of, Big Bang cosmology and, the whole thing. The whole thing. The whole shebang. And part of the paradigm of Western education or scholarship is challenge. Don't just accept what challenge it. Look at it afresh. Think out of the box. And is it right? So that's the spirit. Critical analysis. So take that to the Vedic wisdom, and with that mindset of that's how you do scholarship. And you challenge this and challenge that, and you just put it in the garbage can, or like at least a good portion of it, and you maybe can accept something. Anyway, in my preaching to young college students, that's a problem. Or not just young college students. I had a fair amount of recent exchange with Kripamoya Prabhu Prabhupada, a disciple in the UK who's been involved in congregation development in the UK for a few decades. And he was sharing, it's his experience, and I didn't know this, but he said largely, maybe 80% of the audience at the Bhaktivedanta Manor is Gujaratis. I didn't know, so if anything else is much smaller, some Punjabis and some of this and that. But he said, very common, maybe 6 months to a year down the road, if someone starts practicing Krishna consciousness, they have this existential dilemma about Krishna consciousness and science. It's just modern education, and it confronts you, it stares you in the face. How do I deal with this? So it's not just young people in college today, it's people who are in the Western paradigm, and even when they call it theistic, it's maybe not so theistic, it's mechanistic science, which is atheistic. How do you be a theist and buy into mechanistic science? Go well together. But in a land of compulsory education, that's what you get, mechanistic science, from second grade, but to speak of further education. It's challenging to core convictions. So it's these are just some sharing some thoughts on not so much your own individual doubts, but how to help people have, well, what about this thing? How to help get over this thing? Faith in descending knowledge of Vedic wisdom, when it's properly received. So that's a whole other thing. Improperly received is a whole other thing. Anyway, back to this report and verse. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, it may be also here in the Bhagavatam, but specifically there's a section in Chaitanya Charitamrita where Prabhupada writes in consecutive purports that the fall of Jaya Vijaya is not ordinary. It's also in the Bhagavatam, the earlier section. We should not think, every demon that Krishna encounters or others encounter, that's somebody who fell from Vaikuntha and came here and they're doing some service. That's not how one should understand things, although it sounds a little bit like that in this purport. That's a rare exception. So rather, they're living entities that are in this material world who are in the material world because of two reasons, raga and dvesha. They're wanting, they're coveting the position of Purusha, and they have aversion to he who is Purusha. So we take birth here. And some just are, they ramp it up a whole lot. It's a demoniac spirit, and it becomes very amplified over, through austerities and so on and so on and so on. And when that population becomes overburdened on earth, then the Lord descends to eliminate them. It's not like they're all like with the Vasis that fell and they, to give birth the opportunity to for the chivalrous spirit. And then the final is this one. We as devotees should be very careful and not fall from it. In Nectar of Instruction, it's specifically described that the stage of an advanced devotee, the character of an advanced devotee is that's absent. Fall finding is absent. And we'll come down to the rest of us who aren't so advanced devotees. The tendency is there for a variety of reasons. Contamination of heart, a variety of contaminations. The tendency is there. So we should guard against that. It's powerful, but we should not try to find fault. We should try to not find fault. But what do you do instead? The process of discrimination is there. As discussed yesterday, Madhyama Adhikari were enjoined or were trained. It's part of being a Madhyama Adhikari to discriminate this and that. So when you should turn that off. But when you see some discrepancy, how do you handle that? What should happen in your heart and with your spiritual intelligence when you see that? It's important to know what to do because it happens. It happens all the time. We're in a place where there's not perfection, to say the least. So how do you handle that? And for the nth time, I've spoken on this topic so many times, but if we're in the mood of service, we'll be protected from that fault finding. And one can then consider, how can I give some assistance to in this situation, in this dynamic? Maybe there's not any clear sense of what I can do, but at least that will protect one from fault finding. And that will be discussed that a little bit last night. There are some paths to go down that can be of assistance, that is not fault-finding. Another is, if it's the nature of the place, it's a place where it's an ocean of faults. Kalir dosha nidheda jan. Dosha means fault. If this place, in this age of Kali in particular, it's an ocean of fault. It's not a, you know, you're a brilliant person because you found the fault. It's an ocean of faults. And what to do about it? Janar Krishna. Just make a Mahan Gunan. Kirtan Adiga Pritsha. Let's get together and have kirtan. Let's get together and have hearing and chanting. And on the basis of hearing and chanting, some purification and some appreciation of one another, and then one can speak about, you know, some fault in a proper mood, where there's some relationship of common service and appreciation of one another. That's a nice path to go. That's our program. Or become oneself pure, so that by association of purity, then that which is with this dosha can be relieved by purity, by an instrument of being an instrument of Krishna, an instrument of Krishna's purity. Like that. Pray to Krishna for the welfare of those inflicted by the ocean of faults surrounding us. So, any discussion?
Guru Maharaj, you were mentioning that you know, the scientific approach of the modern day education is also like they would like to analyze an experiment and then come to conclusion. And on the other side, we also say that the spiritual things we should not accept it blindly. We also kind of do our analysis and do the right way, and you know, I'm talking about the empirical knowledge and the experimental knowledge. So how do we see that? I mean, if someone asks that question, saying, you know, we do experiments and come to conclusion that, you know, this is not existing or this is right, but what kind of experiments do you guys do? You also say that you don't have to accept anything blindly, so what is the thing that you follow?
You said that I said some things that I didn't say, but that's okay. And just keep it simple, two things. We have our experience. Prabhupada's answer to that is, here's the experiment. Chant the Maha Mantra. No. But if you don't do the experiment, how do you see the results of the experiment? There's the hypothesis, there's the experiment, there's the observations, and there's the conclusions. That's the scientific method. So here's the hypothesis, here's the experiment. No, I won't do it. So no observations. That's one thing. That is our methodology. But then another thing is, here's the hypothesis, that there are some things that are beyond our empiric capacity to perceive and understand and know. But if one undergoes the process of purification, it can be revealed. It's not understood by ascending, it's understood by descending knowledge. That's our hypothesis. Now, here's the experiment. Devotional service, pursuing Shuddha Bhakti from the contaminated to become unconditioned. And I won't do that. So for us, as sadhakas, we're accepting and we're undergoing the experiment. And we all have the experience that things that were undiscernible before become clear. At least gradually, more clear. Like that little talkative girl yesterday, I don't know who she is. She said, "Are you American?" I said, "Not sure at all." She said, "I'm Indian." I said, no, you're spirit soul. She said, I'm not spirit soul. I'm Indian. I said, that's not what Krishna says. She said, I don't care what Krishna says. I'm Indian. She didn't say, I don't care what Krishna says. She said, I'm not spirit soul. Okay. So to understand, for that girl to grow up and understand that she's spirit soul, it's going to take a while. In part, it's just like childishness, but... So we may say, okay, I'm spirit soul, but what is our realization of that? But as we go progressively further on the experiment of Krishna consciousness, it becomes more clear. Or, Prabhupada would say, this is now theory or philosophy, but what's the difference between the dead body and the living body? There's something that changes, and you analyze the elements, and all the elements are there between the moment of life and then the death. So what's changed? Something that was there is no longer there. What is it? Whatever that is, that's what spirit soul is. Or bodies that are without the soul, they're heavier. Right? Prabhupada asked Sort of Damodar, is it true? And then he confirmed, yes. You weigh a body that's alive, the same body after the soul leaves, it's heavier. So, why? Yes, no?
Yes. Then you don't know. Yes.
So why? We don't know. So there's an answer. But we don't know. That's your theory. I'm a scientist, and I say, I don't know. Because it's... In one sense, it's an honest statement because it's not something I can measure. It's not something I can know. Because I can know only what my instruments can measure. You can't measure the soul, but it's the presence and absence. I don't know. It's an interesting theory, but I don't know. It's an honest evaluation from an empiric stance. So, from our experience, there's a theory, a hypothesis, and then, gradually these things become realizable that are otherwise beyond the sensual perception or even extensions, instruments that are expanding what senses can do, just refinements of what senses can do, like telescopes and microscopes and things. But still can't find the soul. By our process, things can be realized. And that's part of the science. It's spiritual science. They go, oh, garbage. And we go, okay. We're going to follow our process and become realized. As much as you realize what your senses say, even more than that, we can realize spiritual knowledge. It's disclosed in that state where it's, that's our spiritual science. That's our answer to that. We're not just accepting on blind faith. There's Timothy Krishna Maharaj prepared a little book, Faith and Reason. So we're accepting the theory of that which is beyond our senses to reckon, based on reason. We have reason, not blind acceptance. It's with reason. It's not proof. Reason isn't proof. We need to, because there's reason, we invest enough faith in the process to do the experiment. And gradual realizations, unfolding of realizations, confirms that faith that we initially invested based upon reason. Anyway, it's in that book, he's one very elaborately, the connection between faith and reason.
Guru Maharaj, you mentioned that we get into certain situations, we see certain situations and we are wondering like why this happened, and again Krishna has given this situation, so we accept it that way. But the question that I have is, we can accept it, I have also encountered certain situations, I know why that has happened. Okay, Krishna has given this situation, but every day when I am facing that obstacle, I don't know the purpose why Krishna has given the situation, and that bewilders, that affects the mind.
You have to be patient. and inquisitive. The inquisitive isn't that immediately Krishna is going to give the answer, but the inquisitive spirit is good, patience is good, and faith that behind this puzzle there is a plan. I don't know what the plan is, but I have faith that there is a plan. I'm inquisitive to know, and I'm patient to find out, because I can't demand anything. I can be patiently, intelligently inquire and trust. That's how you know. So that's a spiritual gift. And one that doesn't have the spiritual gift or has a weakness in that department of spiritual gift, then it's turmoil. And I can't think straight, I can't act with clarity, it disturbs everything, my relationships and my work and my life and my mind. And so there's protection in having that spiritual gift, so then cultivate it.
Thank you, Maharaj. It's a technical question. Of the two brothers, Jaya and Vijaya, is it mentioned anywhere that one is fighting but the other is not? Because if we see Hiranyaksha fighted with the Lord, but Hiranyakashipu did not. Same with Ravana and Kumbhakarna.
Are you sure? Hiranyakashipu didn't fight?
Not at the same time, I think he's asking. Same time, is that what it is?
Hiranyaksha fought and Hiranyakashipu fought. Ravana fought and Kumbhakarna fought.
With the Lord?
Yeah.
Didn't
what book are you reading? It might be a different book.
And didn't just Lord just kill Hiranyakashipu on his lap immediately?
Yeah. Well, not immediately, he had some fun first. Okay. Both fine. Both okay. By the Lord. Yes.
My question very most of the time asked by non-devotees is that a lot of Mahatmas also undergo the pain.
Well, who does? Mahatmas.
Yeah. At the end of their life, they did so many good things. They were so much Krishna conscious. But at the end of the day, end of life, they went through some kind of cancer, some kind of different kind of pains. So how do you explain that?
How do you explain it?
I have no clear explanation.
Supposing you jump out the window and you're falling and you pray to God and you become very intensely praying to God, you're not going to crash when you hit the pavement? For one who takes birth in this world, similarly, there's a cause. Commonly. I mean, there's exceptions, but commonly there's a cause. And that cause is raga and dvesha. And then, after taking birth in this world, this is like the conditioned soul becomes a holy man or woman. They turn their attention to God. So now, what about that act of, that which brought about their having a material body that's going to deteriorate? So now there are different things that happen at the time of death, depending upon the Lord's arrangement. And some, it's painful, and some it's like miraculous. No pain. Or they transcend pain. Like one of the things that Prabhupada spoke about is that Christ suffered. The transcendentalist doesn't suffer. Well, of course he suffered because look at this and that, and that suffering. But where was his consciousness? So, when there's all, that's the whole theological thing from the Christian perspective. Well, that's his divinity because he suffered for us and so like that. But then another perspective is he didn't suffer. Although, looks sort of looked like it. So that's a whole other factor. So if you know, then there are persons who descend from, like, you know, let's say preachers, because here Prabhupada, the purport, is speaking about persons, residents of the spiritual world who descend, like Johnny Vijay did, and became demons, and there's some who descend for purposes of serving the Lord. And they get a material body. And the material body at the time of death is just painful. The range of what might be the experience of, you know, the external perception of events and the experience of those external perception of events, is there's a whole big range. But it's then something like the description of Bhishma fighting with Krishna. Bhishma shot arrows at Krishna, and Krishna was the love bite of the lover, like that. It was ecstatic. So, or similarly, the love that a mother has for a child. You know, I look at what that's going on, and it's awful. For the mother, it's wonderful. You know, making messes and crying and screaming and changing diapers and the whole program. Yeah, yuck. But for the mother, it's wonderful. So, similarly, when the devotee is experiencing some inconvenience on behalf of the Lord, it's wonderful. Etc. Protected and, you know, leaving the body. It's not fun, but, you know, he wanted to leave the body because he didn't want to experience the pain of separation of the Lord leaving first, so he wanted to leave first. But he left his body. So there's so many plans of the Lord, or reciprocations with each individual for different circumstances, and if there is some discomfort or pain, the devotee, the elevated devotee, takes it as, this is just part of my service to the Lord. And we're not lamenting, oh, I did so many nice things, why do I have to have some pain? Not thinking like that. Their consciousness is somewhere else. They may be aware, but detached from the circumstance, because their consciousness is in another place altogether. And persons that are involved, that I had a fair amount of dialogue with the hospice care people in Vrindavan. And a little sharing from their side is, in short, I think it's a little bit longer, but in short, many cases, not in all cases, but in many cases, the passing of devotees is, although their bodies racked with pain, it's very clear from their facial expression and other things, they're very peaceful and very happy. In that, in Vrindavan, under Krishna's care, in the presence of Kirtan, with the prayers of the devotees, and it's wonderful. Where it should be, terribly painful. So if one has shelter, it's a whole other experience than if one doesn't have shelter. Anatta and sanatta. Experiencing life, including death, is a whole other experience. So we can't exactly understand what that experience is like. It's different for each relationship with Krishna.
So we may think that they are going through the pain, but they really may not be feeling you.
Yeah. And if they are, it's an act of love, like the mother taking care of the child, kind of thing. But it's, you know, it's happiness. It's part of their offering of love to the Supreme Lord. Depends, you know, there's all kinds of variety of things going on.
So like recently, Rup Sanatan Prabhu?
Yeah.
He died of cancer, but he was in the midst of kirtan.
And et cetera, et cetera. He was feeling, he was feeling Krishna's shelter. Very sincere person. Incredibly sincere person. He was in a lot of pain. He had painkillers. He was in a lot of pain. But his consciousness was with Krishna. I'm not saying he was a pure, perfected soul. But he was in that place. I spoke with him he didn't respond because his body couldn't respond. But by phone, and that the doctor said, you know, his facial expression showed that he was hearing and responding. It was wonderful. I don't have, fortunately, knowing that, I don't have this, you know, going to the other side, this thing, oh, how unfortunate. Just like the thoughts don't even go there, the feelings don't go there, because it was so fortunate, it was so blessed. May I also pass in that situation? Fantastic. Whatever the pain is, I like this. That's no problem. Let me do that part. Mm-hmm. Like that.
And he could make the decision last minute that I have to go to Vrindavan.
He was resisting because his body was so debilitated. And frankly, he became a little deranged. But when he spoke with some devotee hospice, you know, professional, and they explained what and why he should go, what would happen, and, you know, because they witnessed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of passings of souls. But that's their profession. So they knew how to, and he said, okay, I'm going. And somebody went with him. It was a roller coaster. When we got there, he was fine. That long thing, I didn't know if he would live, the plane, but when he got there, they didn't take him out in a wheelchair. He walked off the plane. Then he got to the hospice, and he had some recovery time, but then he was walking around the hospice on occasions. And then the very next day, he was unconscious for 3 days. So it was like a roller coaster. And who knows what that felt like, being the body that's in that condition. But his faith was very strong. It didn't, you know, it was the right, it was fantastic. Really, really fantastic. Anything from you, Sam? Yes?
Probably answered this question partly, but I wanted to understand the space between discrimination and leading to fault finding. What are some of the checkpoints where I could check myself?
Immediately. Two things. Mood of service. And am I seeing the big picture? Like the person. Not just the behavior. But the person, like, you know, let's say the heart of the person wants to, like I want to, develop in a Krishna conscious way, my relationship with Krishna and my manifesting purity instead of impurity. See that? Am I seeing that? Or am I seeing the spot on the moon instead of the light of the moon? Those two things, immediate. Then I guess, you know, a third is, what does the tongue want to do about it? The urges, anger, you know, the six, tongue. when there's the mood of service, or if there's well-wishing, one of these days we'll invite Anuttama to come and teach his leadership and management course. But one of the elements of that leadership course is giving feedback. He went through this so many times, it's stuck embedded. What's the purpose of feedback? Answer: improvement. Not so many other things, but improvement. So if you want improvement, that's the purpose. What's the best way? And then the answer is, feedback is best when appreciation, room for improvement, appreciation. So when you get some feedback like that, how does it feel? Fantastic. I have room for improvement. Let's go. But if you get just, you know, not just room for improvement, but this is bad. How does it feel? It doesn't feel the same. So now, let me be an instrument for improvement. So here's something that could use. So, what's my mindset? And am I ready to express appreciation? Not just, you know, because that's how you're supposed to do it, because I feel it. Appreciation. Room for improvement. And one of the ways to practice that is in the home. Charity begins at home. So appreciation. Room for improvement. And if that's the culture in the home, it becomes the culture in your life. And you're, you know, you have a mind that has a path to go that's nice. When you see something that's, like, you know, not what it should be. And the world is filled with stuff that's not what it should be. See the big picture. And be ready to, if I'm going to do something or express something, let it be like that.
As a continuation of that, from the fault finding, I know there is a lot of fault finding tendency, but from the past, even from the advanced devotees, if I felt insulted or any of those things, I'm finding it difficult to appreciate or even serve them genuinely. So do I just wait till it is genuine from my heart, or do I just practice it mechanically?
Well, you take those two options, and obviously it's not the second one. But there may be other options besides those two. Create another option. Okay, I'm walking through the forest. Visual. I'm walking through the forest. And I notice over there it looks like there's a path. That means there was a path right in the middle of the forest. It's not kind of overgrown, but there's a little path. Now, how did that path happen? Somebody went up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down and made a path. That's why there's a path. And they haven't been doing it in a while, so now it's kind of overgrown. Now I'm walking through the forest, and I don't want to go where the path goes, I want to go over there. So what to do? Go up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down, and next thing you know, there's a path. Okay, so now, life. I'm walking through the path of life, and there's this path that says when I see something I get angry and I feel hurt and stuff like that. There's a path. I want another path. But there's no other path. Well, great path. I just go up and down and up and down and up and down. And the next thing, you know, there's a path. So when I get to that fork, that now there's another path. I can choose this one. And if I cultivate and practice and practice and practice and practice, there's a path. Becomes second nature. You just go there instead of there. what's easier to go the other way? With reason, I'm not so happy with that other one. I want a different one. It works. By Prabhupada's statement is, by cultivation, something becomes second nature. By regular practice, something becomes second nature. So there's my nature, and then there's second nature. But the nature is actually just conditioning. It's not really what my nature is. It's my conditioning. And due to conditioning, something back there, when people say something, I feel something. And I just get absorbed in that feeling, and I can't even see anything but that feeling. That's my conditioned nature. I'm not happy with that. So I cultivate something else. In the beginning, walking through a forest where there is no path, it's a little arduous. And sometimes you may have to move something from here to there, and so you have a path.
So if I'm understanding it right, even if there is some hesitation, I need to make that small step.
Make a choice, because free will choice is part of the soul. I choose this, and I choose not that. This has some, it's there's a little challenge in it, it's this. But I choose it. So that's what's operative is my free will, and so here I go. And then there are persons in my life who will help me support that choice. If not, I'm on my own. I'm getting some support to do this instead of that. And then they'll help you, or they'll encourage you, or they'll hold your hand or walk down the path with you a little bit. And whatever it is that's needed to help, that become second nature, become your nature. It's not a small thing, but side by side with that is growing in Krishna consciousness. And then that's like spiritual strength, not just changing habit. That's fantastic. But going that other way has been blocking my spiritual progress, that's one of the reasons why, besides I don't like it, it's blocking my spiritual progress.
I don't know if I should be asking or not, Guru Maharaj. You just mentioned about Darwin's theory, which is against the scriptural theory. Not theory, scriptural things. I, as a biology teacher, have to teach Darwin's theory. And I'll also have to probably do some dissections. So I'm at a state right now where I'm not able to figure out. I understand it's not something that I should be doing.
Uh-huh.
And since this is a part of the job,
yeah.
I don't know, it's very hard for me to move forward.
Well, here's a few things. Public school?
Community college.
Does your department have strict rules about what you're supposed to say and you can't say? When it comes to I don't know, but here's something I would, if I was in your situation, I would consider two things. One is, go to the supervisor or department or whatever it is, and say, I have a personal perspective on, first of all, Darwinian evolution is not about chemical evolution, it's about selection of species.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to teach chemical evolution, you teach selection of species, Darwin's teaching. I, for one, when I'm asked this question, do you believe in Darwinian evolution? I say, well, microevolution is fine, but macroevolution is something else. And chemical evolution is another category altogether. But just on Darwinian evolution, microevolution is fine, it's observable. So there's no denying that. But, you know, the quantum jump that says monkeys become men, I have a problem with that, just, you know, because it's not observable. Scientifically, it's not observable. It's a theory. Microevolution is what? Fine. Macro, something else. So now, I'm a teacher, and I'm prepared to teach. This is what Darwin says. You're my supervisor, you're the department chairman. Am I allowed in the classroom to say what I just told you? And, you know, personal view is microevolution is fine and macroevolution is, you know, I'm not so comfortable with that. And just leave it at that. Not go into theism or deism or something. Just say I'm not so comfortable with that because it's not observable. But microevolution is fine. Is that okay? You can ask the department chairman. Sure, you can say that. If it's reported to you that I said we have to have God in the picture, know that I'm not going to say that. If it's reported to you that I said that, that is my conviction, but I'm not going to say that in the classroom. I'll just say I'm not comfortable with macroevolution. Is that okay? So you're protected in case somebody says, oh, she's doing something she didn't do. Then with dissection, I don't know. Here's one thing that I've heard is done sometimes is rather than physical, it's done digital. And you ask the department chairman, I'm not comfortable with the physical. Can we go in the direction of digital? You just do it, you know, like that. And they'll say yes or no.
I have tried indirectly, but the problem is the whole department is very pro for all these types of work. And whenever we talk about digital, like I have done virtual labs in my
previous. Yeah, virtual. Year. I meant virtual. Yes.
And immediately they raise their hand saying that, oh, it doesn't teach anything, and like there's no one to support you. So then you are left all alone in the rooms. Like, okay, I'm the only one who is.
Well, here's a couple of options then. One, these are three options. One is, okay, you're not comfortable with that. I'm comfortable with it. Department, can you give me permission to do it? Or, here's another option. When it comes to this, because I just have personal convictions that make me uncomfortable, someone can come in and do that. And here's a third option. Find a place that's okay with your convictions. Those are three options. Besides just the fourth option is just close your eyes and keep doing it. Those are some possibilities.
It makes sense to me. Thank you.
And here's another option. If all those are zero, and there's no other place that's ready to accommodate, you know, what you're comfortable with, consider how you can, from today, over the next some number of years, move your career to a place where you don't have to do those things that make you uncomfortable. In other words, you got to where you are because of who knows how many hours and years of, and now you have responsibility. You can't just like, I'm going to quit. You have to maybe do something today that will get you, you know, in a few years to do something where you're not compromised. And maybe you want to do that anyways. maybe. But it's not uncommon for devotees to be in a position that career-wise I'm compromised and I don't know what to do. So that's an option. Some additional, whatever it is, preparation, training, degree or study or something, I can move from this to that, transition in a comfortable way to do something that's not, I'm not compromised. The whole of the profession, they can do it, you know, they can make their choices, I'm making my choice.
It's not a question, but it is adding to what Gayatri Mother asked and what you have said. When I first had heard this example, I have told this forest path multiple times, but first time when I heard it, it was like an inspiration. It was wonderful to hear. So I have tried to apply that, and when I try to do this new path, I have found that expectation also comes with it.
Expectation comes with it.
With it. Because I am creating this, I also want the other person to walk quarter way or halfway. So I was thinking that, you know, this is once again becoming the issue for me. So I have made it very conscious that when I do this, I will keep no expectations. And that is also based on what you have said in your lectures. But I just wanted to...
And that's fruitive mentality and mode of goodness. Reduces fruitive mentality. I'm going this way because it matches my convictions. It resonates with me, and that's all I need. It's connecting me to Krishna instead of disconnecting me with, you know, the material energy from disconnecting me from Krishna by the force of the darker modes of nature. I don't want it. I want it's between me and Krishna. And people can like it or not like it, or move or not move, or, you know, it's my conviction. It takes some courage, and takes some faith, and takes some spiritual strength to keep doing that. Keep moving that little spiritual faith muscle, and just, you know, and grow. And you'll feel closer to Krishna, and that's a good feeling. Thank you very much. Thank you.